Welcome to the Visual Impact Podcast, bringing you conversations and insights from the world of filmmaking. I'm Rob Newton, and today we are talking to award-winning director of photography, Stuart Biddlecomb, about his work on the critically acclaimed drama series, The Handmaid's Tale, Season 3. If you haven't seen it, this multi-Emmy award-winning US drama is set in a dystopian future where fertile women are forced into childbearing slavery under a fundamentalist dictatorship. Based on the best-selling novel by Margaret Atwood, it is the first series on a streaming service to win an Emmy for Outstanding Series. Stuart, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for asking me. Yeah, good to be here.
Okay, no worries. Perhaps you could start just by telling us a little bit about your background and how you got into the industry.
Yeah, so I think I got into the industry in a relatively traditional way. I guess it was back in the late 90s. I used to be a TV camera operator, multi-camera down on the down in the South Bank, LWT.
Okay.
Doing such fantastic shows as Blind Date, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, all that kind of stuff. Was it Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? No, that was on Elstree. But anyway, but yeah, so it was a big kind of multi-camera shows in the 90s. That was probably my late 20s, and I remember it quite distinctly. I was holding a mid shot of, I think Chris Tarrant would have been Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, okay, I'm doing it.
I've done this.
Exactly, I've done it. I'm here.
Yeah.
And I just thought, okay, well, is this what I'm going to be doing for the next 30, 40 years? And I kind of thought, no, I'm not sure I do. I mean, I loved it. It was good fun, and I loved the people. But I wanted more. Mm-hmm. I wanted to, you know, to try and explore myself a little bit
sure.
further. So I applied to go to National Film and Television School, and luckily enough, I got in. So I went to film school for 2 years, fantastic 2 years of my life. Graduated, had an appalling 2 years of my life because I was unemployed. I had a fantastic career as a studio camera operator, and then was unemployed. I think when you go to film school, I kind of assumed that I'd go and then leave and I would be shooting Bond. But
yes.
Of course, that doesn't happen. Far from it. So you kind of, you know, you scratch around for 2 years, shooting whatever you can. I kind of shot music videos, low-budget commercials. And then I was lucky enough to get Doctors, which, you know, is a fairly, no, which for people don't know, it's just a soap. But it was kind of my first step into shooting TV.
Right.
And then from then, I kind of worked my way up. Up into Casualty, Doctor Who, Sherlock, Call the Midwife, and ultimately to The Handmaid's Tale, which I shot early in the year.
Terrific. And how would you describe your approach as a cinematographer?
I mean, I guess I'm, to give you a bit of a background, I grew up in rural Hampshire. I'm the youngest of three boys. And as a result, I'm a pretty shy person. I'm pretty quiet. I'm more of an observer and a thinker. I don't like really being the centre of attention. And I think that's kind of reflected in the way I work. I think it's important for me to think about a script and think about how I connect with it in a fairly sort of fundamental way. I think fundamentally we are storytellers. I don't necessarily think that being a cinematographer although we do have to be kind of sort of quite technically able, I don't think it should be the first and foremost thing of what I do.
Yeah.
So I'm very much how we can push the story through in a more of a visual kind of way, as opposed to the technical side of it. You know, it is incredibly important in what we do, but it shouldn't be first and foremost. These are purely tools. I like to think I'm, you know, probably a slightly quieter DOP. You know, I'm not into flashy cameras. Yeah, exactly. And big setups. You know, I like to keep myself as small as possible. I like to be invisible. You know, what's important is what you photograph and what's happening in front of the camera, as opposed to, you know, the technical you've got around the corner, or, you know, some flashy camera. Those type of things are important, but for me, I don't think they're quite as important. You know, what's important is with the director and what's, you know, the performances you're trying to capture.
Sure, because a lot of people can, you know, when they're actually buying cameras or looking at cameras,
yeah,
some people go in with a sort of a tick box thing. If it's got to be 4K, if it's not 4K, it won't work, and the rest of it.
I think that's it, and I don't really buy into that. I mean, I understand. I know there's certain channels which require, you know, certain resolutions, and I don't necessarily agree with that. In all honesty, I think, is it a way to sell more TVs? Is it a way to sell more subscriptions? Possibly. I wouldn't like to say, but for me, these aren't the important things. What is important is the scripts, the performances.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. You know, it's great to shoot on, the Alexa. You know, of course. But could you shoot something on your iPhone, which is just as interesting, just as appealing? You probably could. I think you could. You know, they both, you know, each have their own unique capabilities. So I don't think, you know, we shouldn't be, you should never be bogged down on the technicality of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not it's not a technical process. It's more of an artistic process.
Sure.
Without sounding incredibly up my own backside.
No, not at all. So in terms of that then, what were your earlier influences? Was it more of an art background, or was it more technical? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it was technical. In honesty, I mean, I say all this, but when I first joined the NFTS, it was entirely technical. I wanted to learn about film stocks, about lenses, about cameras.
Yeah.
You know, the technicalities of filmmaking is kind of what interested me. But what I very quickly learned, with the help of my tutors, we had Brian Tufano, a fantastic tutor. He very quickly taught me that these are a very small aspect of being a cinematographer. What's important is understanding a script, your interpersonal skills, speaking to crew, speaking to directors, speaking to actors. You know, they're the kind of traits which, being as a cinematographer, kind of separates you from being just a mere technician.
Yeah.
So for me, it was... So Brian was a fantastic influence on me.
Brilliant. Okay. Let's move on to main focus, I think, for this podcast is The Handmaid's Tale, which I must admit I hadn't watched much of it until...
That's okay.
We managed to get you for an hour or so to tell us about it.
Sure. Yeah.
So I've sort of done a bit of a download.
How was that? I should imagine that was pretty hard, Gary.
It was, because I didn't... Because it is quite sort of dire and sparse.
Absolutely.
And there's lots of horrific things. But the more you think about it, the more it's almost mirroring true life now, isn't it? With what's going on in America and over here. So
I think that's it. Yeah, I mean, that's probably what drew me to it. But yeah, the same thing. And I'll be absolutely honest, I hadn't watched all of the episodes when I got the call, so I kind of watched them. And my wife, I watched them all in over a couple of days. And my wife just saying, what's the matter? Why are you so miserable? And I just watched them. Just watched five episodes of The Handmaid's Tale. Perhaps I shouldn't go in. But it's true, you know, these type of things, because they're such good, because they're fantastic writing, you get drawn in and you can't not be affected by what you see.
Mm-hmm.
I was incredibly lucky getting Handmaid's Tale. I think as this industry is all about luck and hard work, and the hard work part was I shot something called Hidden, which was a eight-part, very low-budget Welsh TV show.
Which you got a BAFTA for.
That's right. Yeah, I got a Welsh BAFTA. With director Gareth Bryn, and we had a ball. We had an absolutely fantastic time. It's some of my great work, some of my favourite scenes and favourite lighting. We made it for 20 pence, but nevertheless, it was still a fantastic thing to work on. I'm still incredibly proud of it. And the luck part of it was Mike Barker, who is the one of the directors and the executive producer. He was on a transatlantic flight, and someone in front of him was watching Hidden on their iPad. So he liked the look of it, and the rest is kind of history, really. Wow. He called on my agent and asked me if I wanted to come along. So incredibly lucky.
Yeah, as you say, that, you know, if you look at any sort of art type thing, you know, in terms of movies, wherever, and music, it tends to be that right place, right time,
yeah,
bit of luck.
I think you're right. I mean, you do. I think you do make your own luck. Mm. I think that's very true. But you can't. You can never predict that someone will watch your episode on a flight. So it is about luck. But at the same time, if Gareth and I and others hadn't have really put our heart and soul into Hidden, then it wouldn't have made an impression to Mike.
Sure.
So you know, I think if as I said, I think you make your own luck, and if you work hard and if you create good work, I think you'll always get seen. There'll always be an audience for quality work, I think.
Yes, and as you said, the harder you work, I think it was Gary Player going into sports for a moment. He said, the more I practice, the luckier I get.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. You know, I think and when you start out, you just have to keep on shooting, but so that you can just really hone your skills and then, you know, really make it work for you. And then, you know, hopefully one day someone will notice. And on this particular occasion, Mike did. So whoever that guy is who was on the plane, I don't know who he is, but if you're listening, then I owe you a pint.
Fantastic. How did you feel about joining a show that is known for its cinematography? I mean, it is stunning when I was watching it.
Yeah.
You can almost watch it with the sound down.
Yeah, sure.
And it's just terrific.
So. Yeah, I mean, super excited to be asked to do it, but at the same time also incredibly nervous, just as you said. Because it looks so good, you have to bring your A game every single day. You can't, you know, sometimes, you know, you can think, okay, that's not, didn't quite work out as I'd hoped. But on this show, you really had to, you really had to bring it to the table. What made it quite tricky, not tricky, but certainly when I found out my director for my first ever episode was Colin Watkinson, who was the DP, the Emmy award-winning DP from series one and two.
No pressure then.
Exactly that, exactly. Yeah. So when I knew, I just thought, oh my God, this is going to be tough. You know, his work is incredible. You know, he's won, you know, it's the reason why he's won an Emmy for it. So it was very difficult for me to think, okay, this is what I'm going to have to do. But he was great. You know, he really, you know, he looked after me. And it was great for me to be able to learn from the man himself.
Yeah.
Of course, no, things were always going to be tricky for me to think, oh my God, I have to try and reach his level. But he was great. He was very incredibly kind, and you know, he kind of helped me out. So it was, incredibly nerve wracking. But it's in a good way. You know, I think you have to be nervous, I think. But
yes.
Yeah, it was exciting, to say the least.
I can imagine. So, obviously, it had a distinctive style already. Could you sort of adapt and tweak that a little bit or put your own mark on it?
I think to a degree. I think when you come in as a cinematographer, particularly when it's Series 3, which was the series I worked on, the look is pretty much has already been established.
Yeah.
So you can't really, I don't think you can veer wildly into another direction. You still do need to have a degree of continuity.
So
we were pretty much told to, you know, this is what you do, this is the script, off you go, do what you like. But you still need to keep it in the realms of what's been done before. And also I lighten in a different way to how Colin and Zoe do. That's just the way, you know, my sensibilities. Yeah, you're pretty much told to. It's incredibly relaxed, you know. You can, you know, just shoot your line, just make it, and, you know, just make the script work. Yeah, to have that kind of freedom on a show that big was, I think, was incredibly unusual.
Yeah,
and it'd be very rarely did we have anybody from upstairs saying, "Okay, this is what you have to do." It was incredibly liberating. It really was, actually. It's almost like Hidden in a way that we were just kind of left to get on with it.
Mm.
And you know, I appreciate those kind of jobs don't come along very often.
Sure.
But it was one hell of an experience.
So in terms of stylistic rules and things, I suppose you had a framework, but they weren't saying that camera must always be in this.
Yeah. No, we never had any of that at all. I think the only things which were kind of, not set in stone, I suppose, but which were kind of sort of pushed was Colin and Ben, our DIT, had set up quite beautiful looks, which they applied, for example, at day exterior, this was the look applied, and night interior, this was the look applied. So those were very much used. But other than that, Not really. But we did, but we still, I don't know, I analysed the series before, so you kind of, you get into a mindset of going, okay, this is how this works. And then when you're involved in a show for 7 months, you naturally start to work in those kind of ways. I mean, no, because it takes over. You know, you see that you naturally fall into how things have been shot before.
Sure. In the episode Household, I believe Derve LaWalsh was the director, and she was new.
Yeah. We were both new. I loved Derve. She's fantastic. She's a great director. She's got fantastic energy. Sure. When we were doing prep, I remember she came into my office one day and she said, if there's one thing we need to get out of doing Handmaid's Tale, or there's one thing we mustn't do when we're shooting Handmaid's Tale, is get fired. That's the thing. And that kind of came our rally call almost. It's like, no, oh my God, whatever, we must not lose our jobs over this. So it became quite a good kind of a good rapport between us.
Yeah.
That enabled us to produce some really strong work. I'm incredibly proud of that episode.
Mm.
I think it's sort of my finest work. I mean, it was a great script. And when you're given a strong script, it's, as I said before, 90% of your work is already done. And if you're able to capture the performances, capture the script, then you've done your job.
Sure.
So yeah, I loved Derve. I know. I think she was great. And also because I was a newbie, I was from London. She was from Dublin. So we kind of, in the weekends, what did we do? We kind of went, you went around each other's houses and we talked about the show. Because that's all we could do. Everyone else was going back to their homes and their family.
So we just
kind of sat in an apartment in wintry Toronto, trying to think how we could shoot this extraordinary script.
Yeah, because you say it's season three, so a lot of the crew and everyone was probably been on from season one. So that's already a network and a community, and you were sort of being dropped into that.
Exactly. So, I mean, it was quite, this all sounds very poor me, but it was quite lonely in a way.
Mm.
Just because, you're flown out there, you're dumped into a city which you don't know, into a show with plenty of new people. So kind of, to make that work for yourself on a personal level is quite tricky. But when you have Derve, who's kind of going through a similar kind of process with you, then it makes life so much easier. And in a way, it kind of, it helped us out. It meant that we did bond. And those kind of relationships are so important as a cinematographer. The relationship between the DP and the director. Of course, there are other important relationships as well. But our role is so important.
Mm.
And I think if you were able to get a really strong, coherent and easygoing communication method, then you're fine. Then you'll be creating good work. These things are vital.
Yeah, for sure. And it's, I think it's, as I say, an incredible episode I found. So
good. Thank you very much.
I thought it really, really worked well for me. It's
good.
Fantastic. So among some of the great shots in the episodes, the overhead shots, looking down on... It's like a signature perspective, isn't it, for the show in a way?
It is, yeah. I mean, there's one thing I don't... One of my rules as a cinematographer is that I don't think you should do a shot for a shot's sake, just because it looks cool.
Sure.
I don't think you should ever do that. So those kind of those high angle shots were very much discussed through Derve and I through our long wintry Toronto evenings. So each one has a meaning. For example, that shot in the mall, it's a shot of the handmaids all coming to rest, all in unison, and that's trying to portray. That these women have no power, that they're suppressed by the Gilead, by the government.
Yeah.
There's another shot, for example, where June is waiting to meet the Swiss, and it's a top-down shot, and it's a beautiful marble floor, and it kind of looks like a chessboard. And that was, again, that was all quite explained. We came up with this idea about, she's playing a game with Gilead here, a very kind of technical game. And there's another one where we had the, they had an umbrellas, that's right, where we had sort of Gilead workers in black umbrellas going left or right through the frame. and then Lizzie with her red umbrella coming down through the frame, and it's kind of suggesting that she's there to try and cut through you know, the Gilead government. So each one of these shots, although they are beautiful, I guess. They do look cool, but they did have a very specific reason why we did them. And as I said before, I think just to to make a shot just because it looks cool. Mm. I think perhaps you're focusing on the technicalism of the photography as opposed to the script.
Yeah.
As I said before, these things are of a prime importance.
Sure. Yeah, particularly like, again, just going, and this may be a spoiler for some people, but the reveal in the Washington Memorial, you know, when you've done that, the pan round.
Yes.
Lizzie's steady face. Cam, and then you could see the cross in her eye.
Yeah.
And then you revealed it.
Yeah.
I mean, how was that shot?
That was steady cam. So we shot that on the steps at Lincoln Memorial. So that was a, I think it was, if I'm right saying, I think it was two shots. It was a steady cam coming over her shoulder, over her left side, then into a close up, and we then cut into a close up, which was, I think, was probably a macro lens. I think it was, I'm sure the scripts are probably out there. I can't remember whether it was scripted that we saw the reflection of the cross in her eye, but we storyboarded everything. That particular scene, we storyboarded every second of that day. We were only given a day to shoot that entire sequence.
Really?
Yeah. So we knew we only had so many hours of the day. So we everything was planned to an absolute minuscule.
Yes.
Everything about it. So those kind of moments you go, okay, right, this is the time. Okay, now we need to be moving on to this sequence. It worked great. And there's a little bit of VFX, obviously, with the cross.
Yes.
The budget doesn't stretch to that much. Putting a crucifix on the on the mall. But that day was an amazing experience. I'll never forget it.
I was just going to say, what was it like shooting there? And
yeah, great. I mean, we shot it back in February 2019 during the governmental shutdown. So we had a very small window of opportunity.
Right.
So we go, okay, this is the day. And then when you're shooting in the Lincoln Memorial, we were only allowed five people in at a time. And that included the actors as well. So we had two actors. Myself, there's one person spotting me. So in the end, you only had four. So we had to be incredibly respectful of this beautiful place. We couldn't put any kind of track down, any dollies or anything like that because of the beautiful floor. So it was very tricky. And we were only allowed 5 minutes at a time in there before the public. We had to allow the public in because it's a public area.
Right.
So it was incredibly difficult thing to try and work out. As it happened, that whole scene where with Yvonne and Lizzie was supposed to be Steadicam, but then I watched the blocking and I thought, there's no way this is going to work on Steadicam. So I thought, okay, I said, thank you for the Steadicam, thanks for turning up, but I'm going to put it on my shoulder. And when we shot it almost, we didn't really rehearse it that much. We just shot it. We shot it three or four times. And we got, I think it was a fantastic scene. And that was never really the plan. Although we did plan it, sometimes you just got to throw that all out the window
and just
go, okay, this is what we're going to do instead. We also, there's one time where there's a shot of Elizabeth on the steps, and literally just outside my frame, there must have been 1,000 people just watching us.
Really?
I think I had their toes right on there on the frame lines. And they were incredibly well behaved. We turned over, there was absolute silence. Nobody spoke. And the moment cut was shouted, then they all burst out in applause. It was the most surreal experience. It was very odd.
Yes,
very,
because very odd. Passers-by in America are not renowned for that, are they, really?
Exactly.
Because I've read quite a lot about other movies being shot and said they just couldn't keep them quiet and they kept shouting out and wanting selfies and stuff.
I think what happened was, as soon as it got out on Twitter or whatever, that that we were shooting there. I think a lot of fans came in.
Mm.
So I think that they were quite respectful. We had people dressed as handmaids come in, you know, and they were very sweet and they were very kind. And Elizabeth and Yvonne, you know, they mingled in with the crowd as well. It was a hell of a day. I mean, it was, we had, Deborah and I, I'm sure if you work in the industry, you know this, but you have the Benny Hill hour, where at the end of the day, when the sun's setting, you just got to shit. Yeah. And nobody, the Canadians and Americans had no idea what we were talking about. This Benny Hill hour. What the hell are you on about? Benny Hill, who's that? But we, you know, we kind of did that. And we, you know, at the end of the day, we just, you know, got a tenor crane out, put a few lengths of rail down, and we just shot, all the, including that, you know, that top shot of the handmaids. And we just shot, you know, as much as we could, because we knew that we worked non-stop throughout the day. I thought, okay, this is what, finally on the last stretch, this is when we're almost there. But yeah, I mean, amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly worked fantastically well and worth it.
Yes.
You know, from a viewer's perspective.
Good. I'm glad. Stunning. Yeah. When you're given scripts like that, you just think, oh my God. I mean, they also told me how much they spent on that one day, and I wish they hadn't.
No.
I really wish they hadn't. It was, a lot of money.
Yes. the use of light in the show, I think, you know, for me again, is fantastic. You know, yeah. Some of the shots where it goes through and you know, the shutters and the windows and things. So how did you do that?
I think that was kind of we had a great designer, Elizabeth Williams. She was fantastic. We spoke a lot about where to put windows. You know, we kind of knew what the scenes were going to be. And the theme of Handmaid's Tale is, not the theme, but, you know, kind of a visual signature, is that a lot of the action happens near windows. So we kind of knew what the scenes were going to be. And then Davila, I, and Elizabeth Williams, spoke very honestly about, you know, where we can put these windows. So it was very much a collaborative process. And then as soon as we did that, you know, it became relatively straightforward. You know, we kind of used mole beams or DNAs or 12Ks, depending on what type of light we wanted to push through these through these windows to illuminate as possible. And we tried to, on the sets in particular, I tried to light as much as possible from outside, so, you know, the actors could move within that space pretty freely. And then just bringing in, you know, a little bit of bounce or a little bit of ice light, I think, I don't know what they're called over here, I think they're just kind of LEDs basically, so just for a little ping in the eyeballs. And that was pretty much it, really. But yeah, I mean, a little bit of smoke goes a long way as well. But, you know, a mole beam through a window with some smoke is always going to look nice.
It always looks nice.
Yeah. But I mean, if it wasn't for Elizabeth being in, you know, that whole collaborative process, I think it would have been very tricky. But but no, she was on board. She knew exactly what we were doing as cinematographers.
Fantastic. Yeah. What was the hardest scene that you had to shoot in the series, would you say?
I think it would have been the one in Lincoln Memorial. I think. Just given the pressure on that one day, you know, we couldn't go back. We'd know that we had to go that day. If we didn't, we would have been hauled up in front of the Hulu and MGM board. You know, we've just spent so much money and we haven't got it.
We had one shot to do and you didn't.
I know, exactly that. So I think it would have been that. And I think what also made it quite tricky was that none of our crew were from the original crew up in Toronto, so we shot it in Toronto, but we came down to DC to shoot that particular scene. So the only people who were from the original team was myself, Davila, and our first AD, Pierre. So I was working with, I'd never worked with the first, my folks before, I never worked with my gaffer or my grip. So it was incredibly tough. We had to go from 0 to 100 mile an hour like that. You know, we absolutely had to nail it.
Yeah.
So we, you know, we prepped, we planned, and eventually, you know, we pushed it through. But the stress levels on that day were through the roof. I don't know, I'm thinning on top already, but I definitely lost quite a lot of hair that day, that's for sure.
Do you shoot with two cameras often, or is it more singles?
We do, yeah. I'll be honest, I'm sure most DPs are, I'm not particularly fond of shooting two cameras. Because, at some point you will compromise one or the other.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to. If you've got a very emotional sequence, you don't want to put your actors through that same performance 10 or 15 times.
Yeah.
If you can shoot it with two, maybe three cameras, then you can get the performance in one go. And that's always very helpful for, not just for the actors, but also for the cut as well. But But when you obviously, you know, when you do shoot two cameras, you do compromise in one way or other. And kind of when you, as a cinematographer, you need to know what those compromises are and how much you are willing to compromise. I think if you compromise too much, if you think that your lighting or you will not be as good with two cameras, then you say so. And if, thankfully, Devler and many other directors I work with, they go, yeah, of course, yeah, fair enough. I think it's kind of a mutual respect. You know, you always try to do two cameras. I always do because I know it's always good for them in the edit. Mm. But if you say, okay, at this point, you know, I wouldn't be happy with what the second camera were doing, or you compromise both one or the other, then you have to say so. And, you know, you have to call it.
Yeah.
You know, it's important because otherwise, you know, your name's on there, and you know, you can't sit in the screen room and go, oh yeah, that was, yeah, that was. Because we had two cameras out there, that's why that shot looks a bit great. No one's going to go, that's a ridiculous excuse.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we touched on budgets. So how does that influence your choice of shots, would you say?
I think on Handmaids, I don't think budget really affected choice, I don't think. I think even on Hidden or any other kind of lower budget stuff I do, choice of shots would still be the same. I think the way that you approach them would be different.
Okay.
So what I mean by that is, if on Handmaid's Tale you can get a Technicolor, if you wanted a, you know, 35-foot movie bird, they go, yeah, of course, yeah, no problem at all, yeah, and you know, we use it. Whereas on other shows you go, okay, we can't do that, but how can you achieve that shot anyway? You think, okay, well, maybe it's a SCAF tower, maybe it's something else, maybe it's something slightly low tech. And although the shot may not be identical, but the kind of the idea is still the same.
Yeah.
So for me, the budgets don't necessarily change what shots I think I can achieve. I think what having a larger budget does is you have more crew. So if, for example, you say, right, okay, well, I need a Technicolor up on that roof, they go, yeah, of course, yeah, no problem at all. No, we can do that while you're shooting a camera down here.
Yeah.
So I think that's the biggest thing about having a higher budget. But for me, you know, it's also important that when you do prep, never to think about the budget. Never think, oh, well, we can't ask for a drone here because yeah, it's too expensive. You have to throw it all out there and see what comes back.
Mm-hmm.
You have to absolutely shoot for the moon, because if you start putting limits on yourself during prep, then you know where does it end?
Yeah,
you know, exactly that. So you should always, it doesn't matter what it is, always say, I want this. I don't know. That's the only way you can do it. I need this to tell the story.
Yeah.
If you start, you know, limiting yourself before you even start, you're on a slippery slope.
Yeah. Talking about kit, what factors would you say affect your choice of kit? You know, the camera, the lenses, that sort of thing.
I think,
is it artistic or is it cost or is it?
I think it's more because I do like to be quite a small unit. I like to be fast. I don't want to be waiting around for whatever reason for a crane to be coming in and, you know, that kind of stuff. So I do like to be fast. So the way I work is almost, I wouldn't say a documentary because I think it's perhaps a little bit too extreme, but what I do like is very simple, a simple setup. On Handmaids, we use the Arri Alexa, the Mini, and I think that's a really good example of, you know, a really well thought out camera. Mm. Everything's very quick, everything's very simple to use. I do like to keep it simple. I think, as I touched on earlier, I think if you start making it about the process, about the technicalities of it,
yeah,
then your focus is drawn away from, sure, mm, from the performances and, yeah, from the direction. I think it's, you know, we should be as simple as possible. You know, I don't want it to be about me at all. You know, I feel very, you know, I feel my stomach churn when something goes wrong with the camera and the actors are there. I think, oh Christ, you know, this is their time.
Yes.
And if that does happen, not that happens very often. In fact, it happens hardly ever with the Alexa. But no, I feel very uncomfortable at that point.
Yeah.
You know, it should never be about me. It's always about the actors.
Good. What sort of lenses? Can you just give us an idea of what lenses you're using?
Or? Yeah, so we used Colin Watkinson's K35s. They were rehoused and they were beautiful. You know, they flared, and there's a reason why we used them. They were absolutely stunning lenses. They were slightly different speeds. I think a couple had slightly different speeds, but Bernard DIT, he was, you know, he was, you know, he probably knew those lenses better than I did, in all honesty. So he knew what we could get out of them, but they flared, you know, really, really beautifully. You know, I think that's part of the look of the show. You know, is that, you know, you can catch these really stunning flares. I think particularly in the 55mm, and they were great. And then being rehoused, you know, they could have been Cook S4s.
Yeah,
you know, they work seamlessly. We did actually use a set of K35s. We couldn't take those K35s down to DC. We had to hire another set, and we had the original. They weren't rehoused. And my God, they were falling apart. They were, and I had a set of S4s in the truck. I think S4 might have been S5s, but just in case they didn't work.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought, oh my God, I need to have another set just in case. But these particular set, they were great. They're really beautiful lenses.
Did you do any pre-production tests on them, on the kit?
I did to a degree. I kind of came in probably about a quarter of the way through the season, so all the real prep had already been done.
Right. Okay.
In all honesty, I didn't. I spent a few days with Colin and with Zoe, watching how they worked, looking at the rushes, seeing what certain lenses worked with certain setups. So no, in all honesty, I didn't. I did feel a little bit on the back foot. I mean, that I didn't know how the LUTs worked. So my first few days, you know, it was pretty tricky. Just trying to learn about, you know, how they, you know, what had already been established. But, you know, again, working with Colin was a great thing.
A great advantage, yeah.
Yes, exactly, sure. Yeah.
Right, I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap up in a minute.
Sure.
But finally, have you got any advice for up-and-coming cinematographers?
I think shoot anything when you first start out. Shoot, whether it's a music video or commercials or, you know, short films, just shoot anything you can just to get an experience. Once you've got an idea of what you want to do, then you can be a little bit more picky.
Yeah.
But I think when you first start, I think you have to. I think you just need to gain experience from as vast different ways and ideas as possible. Stay fit, eat healthily. You could be away for 7 months, as I was in Handmaid, on incredibly long days. And if you don't look after yourself, you know, you'll burn out in, you know, a few months.
Sure.
So yeah, just look after yourself, and if you can, keep fit, shoot, have fun, you know, find people who you enjoy spending time with.
Yeah.
Try and get a good relationship. Try and get a good focus, put a good gaffer, good grip. Find a director you really enjoy working with, because once you find that, it'll all come.
Yeah.
You know, you start to enjoy it. You start creating some really good work. Once those relationships are established, then you're incredibly lucky. You can create some magnificent work if those key relationships are working.
Yeah, getting the key elements line.
Exactly that. Yeah. That's when the real magic happens.
Yeah.
When things almost become subconscious. You don't even necessarily need to have a conversation with the director or the gaffer. You just need to look at them and they go, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Don't worry, I'm going to do it this way.
Sorted. Yeah.
Exactly that.
Fantastic. Well, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
It's been absolutely brilliant. Thanks for giving up your time and chatting to us on the Visual Impact podcast. I appreciate it.
Pleasure, Rob. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and hopefully we might be able to get you back, tease you back in.
No, I'd love it. Yeah, absolutely.
And talk about something else, you know, in the future, because, as I say, you do great work.
Kind. Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks, Rob.
That was Director of Photography Stuart Biddlecombe talking about his work on The Handmaid's Tale Season 3. Thanks for listening. You can find more podcasts, blogs and exclusive Visual Impact content by going to our website, visuals.co.uk.